Good morning. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm hosting a new KZYX series talking about California. I'm director of the Mendocino Institute, a not-for-profit research and education center. In this series, we're talking to Californians about California, and we will continue, I hope, on a larger canvas, last year's series here, Community and Ecology. You can listen to these discussions on the Mendocino Institute website, www.mendocinoinstitute.org. Today, our guest is Frank Bardicke. Frank Bardicke has been a California activist since the 1960s, when he was a leader of the student anti-war movement in Berkeley, if I remember correctly, a member of the Oakland Seven. In 1970, Frank moved to California's Central Coast, and there he worked for six seasons in the Salinas Valley fields. His latest book, just published by Verso, is the result of that and many more years of work. It is Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, and it's already highly acclaimed. Mike Davis, another California writer who will join us here in a few weeks, says that Frank's new book, quote, evokes the spirit of Steinbeck, resurrecting the true heroes of La Causa, the rank-and-file field workers, and reminding us that the grapes of wrath still remain to be harvested for social justice. Well, let's begin. So again, good morning, listeners. Good morning, Frank. Welcome to KZYX.
Good morning, Cal.
Well, how about getting right at it with your title and working our way through in that direction, Trampling Out the Vintage. What's this about? Why this title, Frank?
Why the title Trampling Out the Vintage, or why the subtitle?
Why the title Trampling Out the Vintage? Can we begin there?
Sure. I mean, it's an old hymn, right? A battle hymn of the Republic. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. And it's meant to be evocative of all the work the UFW did in terms of producing the union that was very strong for a long period of time and which bettered the conditions of farm workers for a long period of time. But it's also meant to suggest that the union hierarchy also trampled out the very best of the union rank and file. That's the idea.
That's the idea of the
book.
So, a good start. Let's go from there to a simpler question, but a big one to help listeners get into the subject. There are farm workers today almost everywhere in the United States, but California farm workers seem somehow special. I think some 36% of the nation's farm workers labor here. And as Julie Guthman explained last week on this show, they tend to work specialty crops, fruit, nuts, vegetables. Let me ask you if you could to tell us in your experience, who they are, the California farm workers, and are they special? Are they unique? Anything that you would like to say as a kind of background to your book, demographically, industrially, what would you tell us?
Well, I mean, there has been actually a lot of work done on this, and even though the fields are a bit of a hidden place, there's so much that goes on off the books in the fields that it's very difficult to try to figure it out, come in as a social science statistician. But there have been recently, though, over the last 10 or 15 years, there have been maybe even a little bit more, there have been a lot of studies of the California fields. And so just off the bat, 90% of California farm workers were not born in California. The second statistic that goes with that is that half of the farm workers in California are the children of farm workers. So how does that figure? How can 90% be not born here, although half of them are the children of California farm workers? Well, the answer is that many, many California farm workers are raised in families in Mexico where one or two or three or four or five of the people of the family are working in California in the fields. And these young people then when they come of age, then they come to California and replace the older people who have been working in their families. This worked quite well for a lot of small communities in Mexico for a really long period of time, because wages in the United States have over time been about like 10 times as much as wages in Mexico. And so what is poor wages in the United States was high wages in Mexico. So through this system of like sending the young people here to work for a few years and sending money back home, California agriculture managed to support a lot of small communities in the Mexican countryside. But it hasn't worked so well in the last few years. For one reason, it's a hell of a lot harder to cross the border. It's more expensive. You can still cross, but it's just expensive. If you want to ride across, the last figure I heard is if you want to ride across in a car at the border station where the guard has been bribed, it costs about $5,000. If you want to go through the desert where it's very dangerous, it's there's a base price of about $1,500, but people are paying more than that now. So it's much harder to go back and forth, which makes that lifestyle that I just described difficult to maintain. And secondly, the situation got so desperate in the Mexican countryside that the remittances from California were no longer able to sustain those small communities, or distorted them in many ways, so that the people who had this, who had a connection to California, sort of had the big cars and big bucks, and everybody else was real poor. It's broken down, and what's happened is that the folks, the sending communities, are moving further and further south. So right now in Watsonville, people are coming back, and you can see that more and more people are from Chiapas or Oaxaca or Guatemala. There's a lot of people are here who don't speak Spanish, who speak only an Indian language. Folks are going for a sort of deeper poverty. More poorer places are sending their folks to California to do the farm work. That's there's a thumbnail sketch for you. Is that what you wanted?
Oh, that's great. And there's been a massive and steady change in demographics over the years. Many people know about your part of the world from John Steinbeck. I know my kids read Steinbeck in school, probably not The Grapes of Wrath, but maybe Of Mice and Men. Certainly that's not the Central Coast anymore. In your lifetime, what kind of changes have you seen in terms of what's called Steinbeck country?
Oh, well, there's been tremendous changes. I just don't know where to begin. Like, let's begin where sort of the birth of the United Farm Workers Union, and when the Bracero program ends in 1964, and there's a strike in the grapes in 1965, out of which the UFW was born. Before that strike, UFW was just sort of a small community organization. Becomes a union in the crucible of the strike. At that time, 65, California farm workers were extremely diverse community, a hell of a lot more diverse than they are now. There were certainly Mexican migrants, but there were also Mexican Americans, people whose grandparents had come in the 1920s. They happened to be right around the Delano area where the UFW was organizing and where that first strike started. That was an enclave of Mexican Americans. There were African Americans. There were, you know, people we call white Americans, Americans of European descent. There were people from Texas, Tejanos, they call them, in the fields. There were settled Mexican-American communities. There were people who weren't migrant, but then also there were migrants. So it was an extremely diverse community. When the Bracero program ended in 1965, after a couple of years of confusion, the border was basically thrown open by consciously underfunding the Border Patrol so that the people who had been the Braceros could come back and get their jobs again, either as green carders or as undocumented workers. So starting in 65, 66, 67, 68, there's this whole new wave of Mexican workers, many of them undocumented, who come into California to do the work. This was conceived of by some folks who worked in the fields, Mexican Americans in particular, as a threat to their jobs, and was reflected in UFW policy, which was anti-immigrant up until 1975. The United Farm Workers Union was opposed to people without papers very virulently and fingered them to the Border Patrol and attacked, tried to get them deported, and tried to organize their union among legalized farm workers here and to exclude people who at the time were called illegals. It was probably the biggest mistake that the UFW made. They reversed that policy in 1975 because the 1975 law that allowed for farm worker representational elections said nothing about any barring of anybody who worked in the fields from voting. So after the 1975 law, illegals could vote in these representational elections, and so the UFW then changed its position no longer attacked the undocumented, except when there were undocumented people who broke their strikes. That's a mouthful, but it's kind of one of the major mistakes that the UFW made. It's kind of like they bet on the wrong horse. They tried to like put their fingers in the dike and stop immigration and exclude the undocumented from the union at the very time where, you know, undocumented were like more than half the people who worked in the fields. So it was a very large mistake, and they paid for it by losing a whole bunch of elections where there were undocumented people who voted.
And the transformation of the workforce from a diverse workforce that you described to what sounds a bit kind of monolithic Mexican now, it seems like it must have been connected to policy, policymakers. Is that right?
Cal, I'm giving sort of so much information here. These questions are actually so complicated in a way. I don't want to swamp you with information, but try and explain it.
People are interested in this, and your answers are great, and we've got time. So
let's do it.
And you know, we're in an agricultural county still up here in Mendocino County.
Okay, so let's go back to 1965.
Yeah.
So in 1965, there were all those diverse groups that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
1964, there were all those diverse groups that I talk about. In addition, in certain areas, there were tens of thousands of braceros. Okay. Braceros were mostly along the coast in vegetables and not in the table grapes. They're mostly along the coast in the vegetables. Now, when the Bracero program ended in 64, there was a bit of panic because who was going to do this work of harvesting the vegetables? And also the lemons. The Braceros almost did almost all of the lemon and orange picking. Who is going to do the work? Now, this is highly skilled work. You can't just recruit anybody to be to cut lettuce or anybody to pick lemons. It's a very highly skilled and difficult work. It's hard to learn and hard to do. So there was this panic about who was going to replace these braceros. And what happened, well, there was an attempt, and the lemons was very interesting because there was an attempt in the lemons to bring people off welfare rolls in Los Angeles, or to bring people from Indian reservations in Arizona and New Mexico, or to bring import African Americans who had some experience in the fields in the Deep South to bring them to pick the lemon trees, and they just couldn't do it. People quit after a couple of days. It was impossible for folks to do the work without being trained and without knowing how to do it. So what they did, and this was a matter of policy, what they did was in the lemons, it's very, very specific. In the lemons, the lemon growers actually sent a delegation of people to Michoacan to find the old lemon Bracero lemon pickers, and they gave them letters saying that they had a job in the United States, a job in Oxnard, and with that letter you could go to the U.S. Embassy in Mexico and get a green card. The INS then began to allow growers to send as many letters as they wanted to get people green cards. There was no limit. As a matter of fact, no one knows how many tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of green cards were issued in the mid-60s because the INS wanted people to have green cards because they knew if the more people could legally come, that would mean the less illegals who would come, and so the INS's job would be easier. So that was one thing we'd done. There was a massive issuance of green cards to ex-braceros. But that wasn't enough. The next thing that they did, in terms of a matter of policy, was that they underfunded the Border Patrol. The New York Times finally, way after the fact, got wind of this and described the Border Patrol in that period as an institution designed to fail. So this is all very matter of fact. The people in Congress who underfunded it were growers themselves from the South. And so when the Border Patrol was underfunded, the border, in fact, if not in theory, was thrown open, and it became incredibly easy for people without papers to come to the United States and work in the field. So what happened was the braceros came back either as green carders, or they came back as undocumented workers. And it was, you know, I worked on a crew when the Border Patrol came in the early 70s, where the Border Patrol came and took people on a Thursday, and people were back to work on a Monday, because all that happened to you was you signed a release saying you wouldn't fight deportation, and then they put you in a bus and they took you to the border in Mexicali, and there was a gate in the fence, and they opened the gate and they backed the back of the bus where the door was, and in the back of a bus, the door, they opened that door and people were funneled in through that gate, and that's all that happened. Nothing else happened. So people just went to the outskirts of Mexicali and recrossed the border. As a matter of fact, there was even one bus, this is in the Los Angeles Times, there was even one bus where the Los Angeles area Border Patrol was picking up too many illegals, and so they didn't have enough buses, so they had to rent Arrow Bus to take some of the undocumented workers back to the border. Well, on the way down, the bus driver made a deal with the people in the bus, and that is that if they ducked down under their seats when he went up to the gate, only a few people would get off, and everybody who would duck down under the seats, he'd take them back to Los Angeles for $75. Which is, it was kind of like the way the thing was designed to be. So getting busted in the early 70s or the late 60s by the Border Patrol just meant a trip to the border, and there was no difficulty in getting back. Now, the border is much, much different today. So this policy of an open border and an easy issuance of green cards meant that the fields became more and more Mexican and less African-American, less Chicano, and less white and less Tejano. It became more and more Mexican, and the percentage of people without papers in the fields grew from a small percentage to whatever it is today, nobody really knows, 60 to 80% or something like that. So that was a matter of policy. And that was... A pr- problem for the United Farm Workers Union.
That's very interesting, and thanks for taking us back there and filling that in. I want to move toward the book, but just one last question before we get right to the heart of the book. And that is, I wonder, in terms of what we've been doing with this program, if you could just tell us a bit personally what it was like for you to work in the fields. It's something that you've written about extensively. I know you're modest, Frank, about it, but what was it like to begin? You must have never done it before, to begin work in the fields.
Well, the basic thing that people should understand about work in the fresh vegetables and fruit is that it's skilled labor. I worked 6 seasons in the fields. By the end, I was just barely an average farm worker. A lot of the images of industrial agriculture that people think of it, you know, the title of everybody's favorite book, Factories in the Fields. People think of the fields as a factory or as an industrial situation. Well, not industrial in the sense in fresh fruits and vegetables that people have been replaced by machinery. People have not been replaced by machinery. People still work with tools in their hands, with cutters and hoes and knives and clippers. And all those tools take time to learn how to use them. And sure, anybody could go in and, if you're given enough time, that you could bend over and cut a piece of lettuce, cut a head of lettuce, but that or climb an apple tree and pick an apple. But to do it quickly enough and fast enough, and if you're working on piece rate, to actually be able to make a living at it and to put up with the pain of being bent over all day, or of just doing hard physical work for 7, 8, 9 hours. 5, 6 days a week for 6 to 8 months in a row. Those all are skills that are embedded in a culture where people grow up working in the fields from the time they're 5 or 6 years old. And you can't just walk onto a crew, even if you've worked physically, and do that work. It takes years to learn how to do it well enough to make a living at it. The other thing about those... So the first thing to understand is that it's highly skilled work, and that people have their tools, and people cherish their tools and take care of their tools and know how to use their tools. And you put a tool in the hand of a person who doesn't know how to use it, and they're going to cut themselves to begin with. Secondly, a lot of the people who were at the heart of the United Farm Workers Union, the heart of their strength, were people who were together on collective piece rate crews. Those are crews where mostly in the lettuce and the celery and the broccoli and to a certain extent in the cauliflower, where people are paid a rate for the crew is paid a rate for the box of lettuce that it produces, and then that rate is shared equally among everybody who works on the crew. You get that? It was sort of everybody is paid the same amount. So this brings people together. It also encourages people to make the jobs equally difficult or equally easy, since everybody's being paid the same, everybody's going to have to work as hard. Also, these crews, if you think of a lettuce crew back in the mid-70s, it stayed together over time. The crew every season, say there's about maybe 35 people on a typical crew of lechugueros, of lettuce cutters. Those 35 people, every year they might lose 2 or 3 people to either old age or some form of dissipation or some problem. But the core of the crew stays together over time. And the people who come on to the crew, the new people who come on to the crew, if the crew doesn't want them to on the crew, they won't make it. So the crews are very tightly organized. There's a tremendous amount of internal solidarity. Also on these crews, many people are relatives. You'll have cousins, brothers, even fathers and sons, often people from the same small towns in Mexico. So there is tremendous internal solidarity on these crews, and when those crews decide to go out on strike, it's never a case where part of the crew will go out on strike and part of the crew will stay working. That never happened. It's always all the crew goes on strike or all the crew doesn't. And then, when they do go on strike, they can only be replaced by people with similar skills. You can't just bring people off the street and send them in there to cut lettuce or cut celery. One of my favorite stories about California agriculture was in the 1970 strike. All the celery cutters in the Salinas Valley went out on strike, and after it had been going on for a few weeks, the bosses decided that they were going to make a demonstration of replacing these celery cutters. And so the celery knife is about 10 inches long, and it's got a strange shape, and it's difficult to know how to use it, and celery packers have a complicated job. If this were television, I could show you the difficulty of celery packing, but you just have to take my word for it. It's very complicated to decide. You pack five different boxes with five different numbers of celeries in them, depending on the size, while you're moving as fast as you can through the fields. So anyway, the bosses called together, made a press release to local newspapers and television, saying that they were going to put together a crew and they were going to go out and cut and pack some celery. They were not stupid, so they called some labor contractors to get together some celery workers to come out and do the work. They were just going to be there when it happened. Well, at that point, the strike was so powerful that the contractors didn't want to anger the UFW because they didn't know what the outcome was going to be, and they wanted to be able to get along with the UFW after the strike was over. So the contractors didn't show up. So there were about 15 or 20 bosses, supervisors, and foremen there, and all the press was there. And when the contractors and the apieros, that's a celery is called apio in Spanish, and so a celery worker is an apiero, when the apieros didn't show up, the bosses decided that they would go out to the fields and they would cut and pack the celery. And so they took everybody out there, and with the newsmen there and the television cameras. And my friend Eric Brazil was one of the newsmen. He was covering the strike for the Salinas Californian. And they worked for about 3 hours, and they couldn't cut and pack a single box of celery, not one.
Hey, this
and,
is.
I mean, it's just, you know, people think of it as unskilled work, but it isn't unskilled work. It's very skilled work. And it continues to be skilled work, and that is sort of hope for organizing in the future, and that is that this kind of agricultural work, this particular kind of agricultural work, fresh fruit and vegetable production, has never been mechanized, never been de-skilled. And that gives workers a considerable amount of power at harvest time.
Okay, this is KZYX. My name is Cal Winslow. Our program is talking about California. It's Californians talking about California. Our guest today is Frank Bardicke. Frank is the author of a highly acclaimed new book. It's called Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. Frank, let's move closer to Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls now, but one more question from the book that I wanted to ask you about, and that is that you say that there's a sort of caricature of the farm worker, which is wrong and unfair, but widespread, and that it was actually important in terms of the foundation and development of the United Farm Workers Union. I wonder if you could just bring that into the discussion.
Well, most people, when they think of farm workers, they still have, you know, the migrant mother, the Dorothea Lange photograph in their mind. There is, or the Grapes of Wrath. I think those are the two dominant images that folks have of what it means to work in the fields. And in fact, farm workers, except for the period, the current period right now, and the period during the Bracero, and the Bracero period, farm workers really haven't been paid all that worse than industrial workers. Because of the vulnerability of the grower during the harvest time, you know, if there's a strike at harvest time, you can't wait the strike out and then after it's over, bring people back and work them triple shifts and then use up all the stuff that you stocked up in the warehouse and to make back some of the money you lost. That just doesn't happen in agriculture because the harvest is, when the harvest comes, you got to get it cut, and if you don't get it cut at the right time, it's lost forever. And this is, California farmers have been complaining about this since the beginning of California agriculture, and their complaints have the basis in reality. Their complaints are legitimate. So during harvests, farm workers have power, and because they're skilled, they have double power. And they have used that over time to actually win things at the harvest, to win higher wages, to win, you know, 5 cents more a bucket, to get rid of a foreman they don't like, to get water into the fields. They have used that power. Now, they were never able to build a union because their power evaporated after the harvest was over. And the growers would be willing to give, you know, 5 cents more a bucket, but wouldn't be willing to sign a contract that would, the union, the workers' power at harvest time and extend it throughout the year. And the workers themselves, who worked for many different companies, weren't that interested in contracts anyway. They were interested in that 5 cents more a bucket they could get right now. So you had a sense of, like, powerful workers who were not that badly paid, except for the Bracero program, which did last 25 years, but who had never been able to build a union. Well, what happened, one way to understand the UFW is that what happened was that power that farm workers have, that periodic power that farm workers have, was connected to a more year-round institutional power of the union, which was maintained by connecting farm workers to their allies in the union movement and among students and among consumers in the cities. So what the UFW did was connect farm workers to their allies which had been in faraway areas in the 1930s, but by the 1960s and 70s, Los Angeles was not that far from Delano, and New York City was not that far from Salinas, as far as it had been in the 1930s. So that's what they did. Now, while there was a strong farm worker movement, there was the UFW linked people up to their allies in the cities through a cry for, a plea for solidarity. That is, the farm workers are in struggle, farm workers are fighting, they're fighting some pretty bad characters, won't you help them out? You, in fact, in solidarity, you may have exactly some of the same enemies they do. Or example would be pesticides. You know, farm workers are struggling against being soaked in pesticides while they work, and pesticides are bad for you as a consumer. So won't you support farm workers in their fight by supporting the UFW? That was a perfectly legitimate and good thing to do. At other periods, however, because of this image of farm workers, of the migrant mother, and of the Okies of Steinbeck, although the Okies of Steinbeck are a pretty complicated picture, but that aside for a moment, what happened was that farm workers were presented to the world of their potential allies as poor people asking for not exactly charity, but asking for help, instead of strong people in struggle asking for justice and wanting solidarity in their struggle for justice. And to a large extent, in those periods where charity trumps solidarity, Farm workers who worked with the UFW were kind of instructed to portray themselves in a way that they weren't. My favorite story about this is involves these lechugueros. Now, the lettuce cutters who I talked about before, who are highly skilled people, they in the mid 1970s, if you were a lechuguero, you could make $18 to $20 an hour if you were on a collective piece rate lettuce crew. That's close to $50 an hour in today's wages. So they were among the best paid people in the U.S. working class at that time. This was because of their skill, because of the periodic nature of the harvest, and because the UFW had connected their periodic power to the allies and the less the country, which gave them a more permanent power. Well, it was the winter time, and the lettuce was being cut in the Imperial Valley, and there was a new boycott that was going to start. I think this is like 76 or 77. There was a new boycott that was going to start, and they were going to start it on a Sunday, and they were going to start it in Los Angeles. They were going to announce it. You know, it was going to be announced at a UFW press conference in Los Angeles. And Marshall Gans, who was an organizer of the UFW, wanted to recruit the lechugueros to go to Los Angeles on their day off and do some lechugueros and to appear at the press conference and in support of the new boycott. There was some other crop that was being boycotted. And people were willing to do it. Now, remember, these are mostly men, young men making $18 to $20 an hour. They had nice clothes. They drove good cars. They were prized in their communities, and they were very proudful. So at the end of the meeting, Gans says, "Oh, and one other thing, don't forget to wear your work clothes." Because, see, Gans didn't want them to go there looking like prosperous workers in the midst of a fight, asking for other people to join their fight. He wanted them to go there looking like poor farm workers who needed your help. And, you know, it pissed the people off. It pissed them off. They didn't want to go pretend that they were something that they weren't. Now, it's a small story, but it's reflective of a problem inside the UFW. And it was the fight that eventually happened between the top leadership of the union and these lechugueros, these committed unionists who were responsible for most of what the UFW had won in the Salinas Valley, and who got in an internal fight with the top leadership of the union and lost.
Well, Frank, maybe you'd better bring Cesar Chavez into the story now. It gets more interesting as we go along. You might need to take a breath here, but...
I don't know. It sounds to me like I go on and on and on. I'm not sure that I have everybody with me.
I go on and on.
Because, you know, if you talk on the radio, you can't really make some sort of judgment about, like, you know, whether people are still listening or not, whether you can when you're talking to somebody to their face. But
I'll be happy to come in and shut you up if necessary.
Okay, please do.
Yeah, I will. But I don't think so. But anyway, let's turn to Cesar Chavez now. Really iconic figure in the United States, internationally, but always connected really with the United Farm Workers Union. So can you bring him in?
Yeah, sure. You can't tell the story without him. There's lots of things. There's lots of things to say about him. One of the useful ways to think about him or to talk about him is to separate his role as kind of the founder of the Chicano people and a example to Latinos in the United States, and the first Latino who really to become a player on the national scene, to separate that from which he is legitimately a hero, kind of the combination of Martin Luther King and Jackie Robinson for Chicanos, to separate that from his role inside the union. And his role inside the union is way more complicated and not necessarily as heroic. So if we start there, The second thing to say about him is remember I've talked about in 1965 when the union starts, that there's all these different kinds of people who work in the fields, including a important enclave around Delano of Chicanos, of people whose grandparents had come to the area, to come to the United States and settled around Delano at the time of the Mexican Revolution in the 1920s. Caesar was, or he was always, you know, Caesar is what he was called by his wife and his children. People now tend to refer to him as Caesar, but he wasn't often called Caesar in his lifetime. Sometimes I call him Caesar, sometimes I call him Caesar. It doesn't bother me that people now want to call him Caesar in honor of the Spanish pronunciation of his name, but it wasn't what he was called at the time. Anyway, Caesar was very much a Mexican-American as opposed to a Mexican. His grandfather voted in a Texas election. His father homesteaded a farm in Arizona. Caesar was born into a Mexican community, a Mexican-American community in Arizona in 1927. And he served in the Second World War, which is another characteristic of that, what they call the Mexican-American generation. So he and his father lost his farm when Caesar was 10 years old during the Depression. And the Chavez family went on the road to California to try to make a living as migrants in the California fields. So to a certain extent, when the Mexican-American community around Delano felt threatened at the end of the Bracero program by this new wave of undocumented workers, Chavez identified with them. He chose to begin organizing in Delano because they were people like him. This is also true of the other founders of the United Farm Workers Union. Dolores Huerta was born in New Mexico, very much a Mexican-American. Gilbert Padilla was born in a labor camp in Los Baños, very much a Mexican-American. Padilla also served in the Second World War. So that's one thing to say, which can sort of make you more sympathetic to the mistake that they made in terms of opposing the undocumented. That mistake also, by the way, is a mistake that the California labor movement made throughout its history up until very recently. There was within the California labor movement, there was an attempt to be exclusionary and to preserve jobs for white American-born workers, and to not even grant union affiliates, which were dominated by non-white workers. So, the other thing to say about Chavez and Gilbert Padilla and Dolores Huerta and Fred Ross, the people who were the original organizers of the UFW, is that for 10 years before they organized the UFW, they organized something called the CSO, which was a Mexican-American civic organization, which was basically organized as a kind of an Alinskyite organization. It was a community organization which fought, which registered voters and fought for things like better roads and better schools and community demands in the barrios of California. And these same four people who built the UFW built the CSO into the most powerful Mexican-American organization in the United States. So they weren't novices when it came time to build the UFW. They weren't novices at all. They were highly skilled organizers, and it wasn't just an accident of the times that allowed them to build the UFW. It had to do with a lot of their own organizational skills. Caesar was also a serious Roman Catholic. He went to Mass more than just on Sundays. The fasts and the penance and the Catholic symbols of the UFW were not just for show. They were an authentic reflection of both the Catholicism of many of the people of in the fields and of Caesar's own faith. He was schooled in something called Catholic Social Action, which is a philosophy that begins at the end of the 19th century, highly developed a set of ideas which promote Catholic lay participation and support Catholic participation in labor unions, but is also at the same time highly suspicious of anything that seems like socialism or too much militancy. So he was schooled in that set of ideas and those sets of practices. When they form the United Farm Workers Union, they bring Caesar, and primarily Caesar, brings the ideas of Catholic social action and the ideas of Alinskyism to the organization of farm workers. And they built an organization, the UFW, in which the top people had an inordinate amount of power compared to the rank and file. The most dramatic way to illustrate that is that inside the United Farm Workers Union, there were no locals. A farm worker could not get elected to a staff position in the UFW. There was no like local business agents or local local presidents or vice presidents. Instead of locals, there were field offices which were appointed by the executive board. And so the people who had the power locally in local areas were people who owed their jobs to the people above them rather than to the workers below them. So now this idea was, I think, part of Catholic social action, was partially a result of Catholic social action, because Catholic social action always believed in the Catholic hierarchy. They didn't, there was sort of the attitude towards the rank and file was the kind of towards the flock that should be taken care of by the hierarchy, and to a certain extent an expression of Alinskyism, where the organizer is the crucial figure, the first figure who makes history, and that the rank and file can be kind of organized into anything. So the people who were the heads of the field offices were people who Chavez and the UFW had trained as organizers, and they were the crucial folks, and the rank and file did not really need to be directly represented. It needed to be mobilized. What happened was that there was a clash between these representatives of these crews that I talked about a little bit before, the crews of lettuce workers and celery workers and broccoli workers. Those folks were responsible for the UFW's victories in the Salinas Valley, and they wanted power inside the union commensurate with their power in the fields. And Chavez and the people around him at the top felt that would diminish their own power, and there was a fight inside the union in which the top officials won. But in the meantime, the most militant representatives of the rank and file were kicked out and purged out of the union, which the top officials won that fight, but in the process they set the union up for defeat. And that's kind of the basic argument. There's another whole argument about the boycott, which I left out, but maybe I should take a little drink of water or something here.
And that's the two souls, and if you're titled,
that's the two souls. The two souls are the farm worker union soul, and the second soul is the sort of the boycott advocacy organizer soul. And they, when the two of them worked together, everything was just fine. And when they were at each other's throats, the union went down.
Well, that let me remind you, this is KZYX, and today we're talking to Frank Bardicke, and we're talking about his new book, in my opinion, a very important new book, Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. Frank, if you're finished with your water there, we've got a few more minutes, and I'd like to ask you, I hope it's not an unfair question, but a question that's on my mind, and that is the question about the future of California, since we're talking about that. Now, it seems to me that this may not be Alabama, and it may not be Arizona, but we seem to be moving from a segregated kind of society to a more segregated society. Certainly up here in Mendocino County, when I think about it, I see a new, young, energetic, growing population of newcomers, Latinos to the county, but people who are virtually unrepresented in government, in administration, in law enforcement, in education, in health services. I wonder if this is similar to other parts of the state, and if you have any ideas based on your long experience of what's happening, and if whether or not there's anything that we can do about it. I remember you started off way back when in the civil rights movement, and you know, do we need a new civil rights movement? What do you think?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, it's certainly the society is becoming more segregated, more divided between a few mostly white, rich, older people and everybody else. And but it doesn't seem to me that the segregation, or at least what I feel around here, it's not so much just a question of Latinos versus establishment. It's a very small number of people at the top versus everybody else. And the Latinos are just a part of it. I mean, I think that the 99% slogan is an excellent one. It's a good way to look at it. California politics, what passes for official California politics is in the grips of the 1%, you know. And all of the rest of us are pretty much disenfranchised, even if we still technically have a vote. There isn't really any way we can vote these guys out of office. There's just no way to do it. And how that came to be is a much bigger story than just the difference between the new wave of immigrants and the old established community. Although the people at the top would like us to think of it that way, and think of the new wave of immigrants as a threat to the society. That's the way I view it. I mean, I don't know about up there in Mendocino, Cal, but here in Santa Cruz and Salinas, in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties, I mean, it's become ludicrous, the state of society. I mean, there's several things that happen. The education system from top to bottom is a total mess. It's just like a total mess. At the very top, University of California, Santa Cruz, is becoming a private school. There's just no doubt about it. It costs like a private school. As a matter of fact, it costs more to go to University of California, Santa Cruz, than it costs to go to Harvard. So it's becoming a private school. It's a larger and larger part of its the way it operates is through endowments and fees that the tuition that the students pay, just like any other private school. At the very bottom, you have the No Child Left Behind and assessment system of education by testing, where in some of the schools in my town where I live in Watsonville, the administrators really expect in the primary grades to be able to walk through the school and go from third grade class to third grade class and find every teacher teaching the same page of the same book, because they're so they are so oriented around doing well on the tests and not be and their test scores being high, and they've been sold this bill of goods. Well, they didn't buy it; it was forced upon them, saying that the way to do that is through these canned curriculums, where you you don't really educate the students, but you train the students to be able to pass these tests, and they want everybody on the same page. So from top to bottom, the educational system is like a total mess. The local state college and the local community colleges are severe cuts. Everybody, the recent report of the community colleges, maybe all the adjunct faculty is going to be cut. They're just going to just going to remain just the tenured faculty. The adult school, which was the place where recent immigrants were educated, is gone. Is one-fifth of the size it was before 2008. It's been totally gutted. So the educational system is a mess. Then there's this really, really bizarre thing that's happened around here, where public facilities, which have been constructed or built, are because there's no operating costs. They have no operating funds. Like they sit there unused. So there's like two really lovely public swimming pools in Santa Cruz County. One of them is totally shut down. It's just a swimming pool. There's nothing wrong with a swimming pool. It's just shut because there's no money to pay anybody to take care of it. And then there's another lovely swimming pool that's open like 2 days a week because there's no money for anybody to take care of it. There's a new courthouse building in Watsonville. A brand new courthouse building was built because contractors could make money off building it, but it's unused. It's unused. All they have is family court, and it was originally set up to be part of the county municipal and court system, and it sits there unused. The libraries, you know, the library, we have a nice new library. Again, it was built because there's sort of money in it for construction. But the library has all these reduced hours, you know, so there's all these public facilities that are that sit vacant because there's no money to operate them. There's no money to operate them because the legislature and the local communities can't tax anybody. If you can't tax anybody, how can you govern? I mean, it's just ludicrous. Watsonville.
Frank, we know the story.
You know the story.
Yeah, it's...
I'm sure it's true in Mendocino,
it's
too.
Really, yeah, it's too
I
much.
I mean, it's true in Mendocino, too. Let me just, like, one other thing. The Pajaro Valley creates $500 million in gross agricultural receipts a year, and we're poor. We're a poor community. Salinas is like Gang Central in California, produces $4 billion in gross receipts in agriculture, and is racked by poverty. So we're like any other third world country, like platform export economy. We send out the nation's vegetables, and we remain poor as hell. People, yesterday, maybe it was the day before yesterday, 2,100 people in a town of like 40,000 people, 2,100 people lined up, clogged the roads to get to the food bank, which gives out free food.
Well, Frank, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop on that not-so-cheerful note. I have 15 more questions here that I wanted to ask you, and I just really don't have time. But I want to thank you very much and conclude again by highly recommending Frank Bardicky's new book, Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. Frank, thanks. We'll talk to you again soon. And I want to thank listeners and say good morning and keep listening. We'll be on next week. Bye-bye.